Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, David, Vicki, and Jay will visit with Dr. Travis Licklider, Extension Agronomist with the University of Kentucky Cooperative Extension Service. Our weekly topic this week will be dicamba and other herbicide uses and technologies for Kentucky soybeans during the 2022 growing season. And as always, we will wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
How you doing, David?
I'm doing pretty good.
It's summertime, isn't it, finally?
It is, just about it, yeah. I've discovered something today on my way into Dixon, and that we are in a geographic anomaly here in Dixon, Kentucky. They actually don't have any Hall's cough drops anywhere near the town of Dixon, Kentucky. So, Vicki,
well,
thank you.
I'm sorry. Appreciate it. I mean, Dixon, Kentucky is a special place, and it's like no other place you're going to travel.
I believe it.
Yeah.
I bet, David, if we got out and looked, there's probably a lot of things that they don't have in Dixon that we might have in, you know, other places.
Oh, that's true.
Nebo or Manitou or someplace like
that's
that.
That's true. You know? But there are some special things we do have, too, that like O.T.'s Cafe up the road.
That is true.
That,
yeah.
You know,
really
the
good.
Homemade breads and things.
It is
so
good.
Mm-hmm. So we have our special places, though.
Yep, I understand.
Always a good thing.
Sure. And there's a lot of corn and soybeans in the ground in Webster County as a whole, but I think that'd be the same across the state of Kentucky.
You know, just 2 weeks ago, we were talking about how behind everybody was, and I think now we could say almost everybody's caught up. It seemed like tractors rolling everywhere, but more importantly than that, the fields that looked like they were having a burn down not long ago, now got corn 4 inches tall.
So. Oh, yeah, definitely. And believe it or not, crops really do look good. I think the beans have really come up good, and corn is looking good. I know down my way they were side dressing corn, and it really has jumped. And some that got side dressed one day and had a rain that night, the next morning it looks like it had jumped a couple of inches, you know. So really, things are really ready to get going and rocking and rolling here for the 2022 crop season.
I agree. I think the thing, you know, we don't like to be late, and, you know, we get nervous when we're late and think that, you know, everything's going the wrong way. But one thing about it, when we are this late and we're planting, those temperatures are so much warmer that when you
plant it
jumps right out of the ground. I mean, it's like you plant it one day and you drive by and
you're seeing
them little rows. And, you know, you don't see that when you're planting early April or late March even.
I get tickled at folks that they fuss about, you know, getting started late and planting late. But if it only takes them 5 days to plant, it doesn't matter if we're planting at the end of March or it's in the middle of May. They're going to do 5 days and they're going to be done planting, you know. So, I mean, it's a weird deal.
But, I had that same thought yesterday looking around at all the corn that's emerged that didn't seem like a week ago was planted. And I'm wondering this year compared to what we might call a normal spring, how much replanting we'll have. I bet we don't have much at all because very, very little of it got planted earlier.
Yep.
I noticed the other day, David, closer to Hopkinsville from your house up there around Ben Wood's property, probably some of the tallest corn I've seen if you've gone past that. I don't know if you know. I started to text you and say, take a look at that because there was stalks that looked like they was a foot tall, you know, at various places across the field.
Yeah, I think there was a little window there that some folks did some planting really early, and I was really kind of concerned that if it was going to even come up or not and what that situation was going to be, but it did. And, you know, thank goodness for all the technologies that we have and the advances in corn hybrids. But, you know, there is a little bit of corn that is pretty good size right now for sure.
I think the one thing that was probably may have caused or could have caused a little hiccup is – you know, those early burn downs and then having that long stretch there to get into planting and maybe having to back up and rethink what we're going to do as far as our pesticide application and how we're going to move forward with that. You know, that's always an issue when you can get in early and then it rains and you're out a month. Mm-hmm. You know, that can always be a stressful situation for some.
Well, that's speaking of burn downs and having to redo things, that's probably a good way to introduce our guest today, Dr. Travis Licklider. He's the Extension Agronomist with the University of Kentucky out of the research station at Princeton, or I guess we could say out of the parking lot at Princeton right now. It's kind of what you got to work with, unfortunately.
Or his vehicle.
out of your vehicle. But Travis, welcome. Glad to have you with us today.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. It's always a pleasure to speak with you guys.
Well, it's we're going to talk about a lot of things today. When we were with you a couple of weeks ago, we said, well, you know, we need to do a show closer to time, maybe just on dicamba because of all that world. But, you know, in this day and age, there are other technologies and are other things to look at. Dicamba is one of those things that folks could have issues with if they're not careful. But I think we could say the same about any of our chemistries if we're not on top of our game.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. And the post-emergence applications, they're right around the corner, like you guys are talking. Lots of corn is up, and, you know, those posts are just right around the corner, and soybeans won't be real far behind them. So there's still a lot of dicamba beans out there, and so it's important to just have a refresher on that and talk about the other technologies as well. And yeah, like you said, all herbicides move, all herbicides drift, so you got to think about every single herbicide application you're making. You need to think about what's around you and the potential of drift.
Well, we're talking about herbicide application in soybeans primarily, but it could apply to any crops. We're in the 2022 growing season, and we're primarily talking about Kentucky crops. We want folks to keep that in mind. I'll give that plug up front that if you're in another state or area and listening to us, be sure and consult with your Department of Agriculture, your Extension Service, and make those applications per the requirements in your state.
Yeah, that's very true, and especially with the new dicamba and even the Enlist labels as well. They are state specific. There's lots of iterations between states, so make sure you're looking at your state. And really, that it applies to almost all herbicide labels. If you look close enough, states differ in their different herbicide labels, but those, it's especially important. So, yep. And you said it, this is for 2022. You never know when things are going to change. I mean, March 15th, there was a change on labeling. Yeah, so
absolutely.
Yeah.
Before we kind of get into some specifics about those things, Travis, tell us a few pointers about some basic things we need to keep up with, you know, kind of like boom height, those kind of things. Just kind of just run through that real quick just to kind of give folks a refresher.
Yeah, so on that, you know, when we're thinking about, you know, our herbicide applications and really just kind of focusing on drift, you know, the first thing is just thinking about, you know, what are the wind speeds? And I know that's hard to control. Well, you can't control it, right? You can't control the wind speed. You can just control when you spray. So trying to find those windows when the wind is the appropriate. So, you know, really dead still, we've learned, is not always the best. So really about 3 to 10 miles an hour is the perfect window, which is a hard window to hit on some of these days. And then outside of that, you know, things that you can control, you know, selecting which nozzles you're using. So every chemistry is a little bit different in what optimal nozzle it uses. A lot of these new herbicide labels give you very specific nozzles to use. And in the case of the dicamba and even the 240 products, there's specific nozzles you have to use. It's not even suggestions. It's you must use these nozzles. But all the other new labeling that's coming out, they're getting a lot better about, rather than just saying, oh, just spray with a medium to coarse droplet, they're doing a lot better job of saying, here's some nozzles that you should be using or thinking about using. So look at that and think about that a little bit, which nozzles you're going to use. But you mentioned boom height. That's one we overlook a lot, but that's extremely important. The booms, you know, with the way your nozzles are spaced and designed, those booms should only be 18 to 24 inches off the target. Okay, so that's a lot lower than what most people are.
And the target is the weed.
Yes, the target is the weed, right? And those weeds should be 2 to 4 inches,
right?
So, you know, really you should only be, you know, a little over 2 foot off of that, off the ground. And I get that's really, really hard to do in Kentucky. We don't have flat fields. We don't have square fields. And most guys are trying to go as fast as that sprayer will go, right? And so it's in, there's nothing worse than putting a boom in the ground and doing a lot of damage, yep. And it puts you out of the field, and it's time and money. So, but it's critical. The higher you put those booms in the air, the longer it takes that droplet to find its target. And the longer it's hanging out in the air, the more likely it is to move off target. So just keep them as low as you can. I understand it's hard to do, but just keep them as low as you can. And if you need to slow down a little bit, it might help you out in the long run.
I think that's one of the things I think producers need to be really aware of when they see these requirements
some of them, like the tip selection, you say it's not a recommendation, it's a requirement. That's what you're supposed to use. When you look at the big picture of all the steps that these companies go through to get a product licensed to sell in a particular area, it's a lot of time, it's a lot of research, it's a lot of money that they have pumped into these products. And producers really need to look at these products as a tool that they have in their toolbox. And to be able to keep that tool around, they need to not just use it responsibly, but use it accordingly to the label recommendation. That label is the law, as we like to say. Yep. Mm-hmm. And if they want to keep these tools and be able to use them, that means being able to help these companies keep these products licensed. And that means use them the way they recommend.
Yep, that's correct.
And, you know, and this is obviously not a mechanical show, but there are things you can do to keep from putting your boom in the ground, the tip. I mean, there's little skid deals, there's wheels, there's lots of different things that people can do to try to keep that from happening. I don't see very many on sprayers, but if you're concerned about putting it in the ground and you're trying to do the right thing and be 18 to 24 inches from that target, you may want to do that just to kind of give you, because there's nothing worse than breaking a boom. I assure you, I've done it. You know, it's not anything worse than having to stop what you're doing, because everybody's always in a hurry wanting to get everything sprayed. So, you know, there are some things you can do to keep that from happening.
Yeah. And you know, there's high-tech options, right? Like the radars that will keep your boom automatically at the height. But there's, you know, you could use some low-tech options too. I mean, that boom's, you know, 45-plus foot, the end of that boom is a long way away from you. And it, you know, to you from that far away, it looks like it's close, but it's not. And so, you know, a real low-tech option is just to hang a length of chain or rope or something off of that. You know, guys used to use their phone markers, but we don't have those anymore, right? Or some guys probably do, but they used to use those kind of as their guidance. But, you know, just hang on something off the end of that boom to kind of give you a gauge of, okay, you know, I'm actually not as close as I think I am.
Yep.
Right? I think a chain is really a perfect use of that. You know, we used, even before foam markers, we used chains as a drag out there for row markers to turn around by.
Right.
Chain's probably the cheapest and easiest thing that somebody could hang and use. I have seen people use like fiberglass flagging poles because they won't bend with the wind like a chain will. They're fairly stagnant as far as going down. But they're white and they're easy to see a lot of times.
Yeah.
What about, you know, as far as drift and things that you can do regardless of the product, but like some anti-drift products, what's your opinion on those? I mean, are those still used? Are they recommended? I mean, what's your opinion on those?
Yeah, so the drift retardants are those types of products, they're available. It really kind of depends on the product you're using. So something like the dicamba products, they require a drift reduction. Most tank mixes require a drift reduction additive. And what that's doing is it essentially makes the solution a little bit more viscous, or less viscous, I should say. And it just gives you a little bit bigger droplet as it comes out of that nozzle. So it really depends on the product that you're using. So if you're using a contact type of product, the problem is you put a drift reduction agent in there and you're making your droplet bigger. So you may be working against yourself as far as efficacy goes as well. So, and also not all, drift reduction agents work well, with the different nozzles that we use, right? So we have like your air induction nozzles. Some of those drift retardants don't really work that greatly with those. You're putting almost too much into there. So those are things you need to consider. So a lot of times it's again, going back to the label and really understanding those labels. And again, for the dicamba product specifically, if you go to the tank mix sites that they have, so all three products have a tank mix site, and it'll specifically tell you, here's the drift reduction agents that you can use and that are effective, and they'll give you the warnings of, okay, but don't use this with an air induction nozzle. And they've kind of weeded those out a little bit, but be aware of that. You know, sometimes too much is not a good thing.
And I think too, like Jay was, you know, was referencing, you know, when these products are not cheap, and I mean, they've never been cheap, but particularly now with the increase in the prices of these, I mean, using those products the way they are meant to use is very important in any year. But if you're wanting to get the maximum control from those products. I mean, you really do need to pay attention to that label and do your very best to apply them according to that label, because that's how they're supposed to work. I mean, that's how they're labeled, because that's how they work. And when we go to changing and doing things different, you're going to need to expect a different control, level of control.
Yeah, that's just an efficiency and an economic decision as well. You know, in any times, we ought to be operating as efficiently as we can. Mm-hmm. But in a year like this, where those margins are going to be so slim anyway, mm-hmm. I don't think there's going to be a lot of room for error on either side.
Yeah, and I think that's we're at a good point right now that we can kind of, let's backtrack a little bit. Travis, talk to us about some of the problems we had in 2021, to some of the things we can learn from to not do again.
Yeah, so in 2021, we really had dicamba off-target issues kind of rear their head again. So it was kind of quiet there, 2019, 2020. I'm not saying it didn't happen in those 2 years, but I just wasn't getting as many calls. But last year, it really blew up, and it's kind of your guys' area is where it really blew up, and we had a lot of issues. So, and I don't know that we can put our finger on one exact issue on that, but the things that we can do for ourselves is really paying attention to weather. I think we are in a situation where we had a few more temperature inversions that we need to pay attention to. Making sure we're using the right tank mixes, using those specific nozzles, and just not, spraying when the wind's not blowing. And also just on the dicamba label, and this is actually on the Enlist label too, so Enlist would be the 240 product. Both of those labels specifically say if there is a sensitive crop downwind, do not spray. Yeah. And I think at least in a lot of situations I went and looked at, that was just ignored. And that's a huge critical mistake that we can't be doing. And I think the other thing that happened for a lot of you guys last year, and I think this is kind of widespread, is the Enlist technology is really starting to compete with the Xtend technology, and we're getting more Enlist soybeans out there. So you don't have this monoculture landscape of all dicamba beans. You've got 2,4-D beans now interspersed within there, and those 2,4-D beans are sensitive to dicamba. So I think that's another thing that happened. And so with that, it's just paying attention, because if you just look at your neighbor's field, they're soybean, but there's nothing on that soybean that tells you, these are Enlist beans or these are Xtend beans. So that's where you have to start having conversations. So if it's somebody's tomatoes, it's pretty obvious those are tomatoes, right? Sure. I need to watch out. Or that's a vineyard, I need to watch out for that. But a soybean field, you need to be communicating with your neighbors about what type of soybeans are you planting, and having that continuous conversation, because then if they've got a sensitive soybean variety, that you need to be careful around that variety. Yeah. So I think that's the other thing, that's the one big thing that we need to learn from, is communicate with your neighbors what you're planting.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I learned last year, in our area, in this McLean, Davis, Hopkins, Webster County area, and all through this kind of Henderson County, those kind of regions, people butt up against each other in, like, it seems like down in, like, Christian County where I live, there's somebody owns the whole bottom. Well, up here, it's not like that. You may have three or four farmers farming in the same bottom. And I think that, to me, I kind of learned that last year, that you've got to be in communication with those folks, and how important that is just tremendous. And talking with those other farmers that are in there, and may even come up with a plan of what you're going to raise in that, because when you're butting up fields against each other, and one of you's got one kind of beans, one of you gets another kind of beans, you've got to be really be careful.
I remember a producer having issues with a neighbor in Drift when I was in Christian County, when I was the agent there. And the same guy contacted me that winter. He said, I want to talk about, some soybean varieties that I can use and I can look at. And I said, so you're going to adopt that technology too? And he laughed. He said, no. But as long as my neighbor is, that's the kind of beans I'm going to need to plant. And that communication was implied, but it wasn't necessarily a sit down conversation needed.
I think that came out when Xtend beans came out, but then when the Enlist beans, it's a different ball game. You got two different kinds of beans. Yeah.
And I do know that's happening. Some they're talking. I know in my county here in Webster County, down in the Otten, Kentucky area, there are several farmers down there that they farm really close together, just like you're talking about. And sometimes there's just a gravel road between them, and sometimes there's a ditch, you know.
Yep.
And I know that, you know, they all met and talked last winter and decided what they was going to do because of that very reason. And I know sometimes it may not seem fair that you got to change what you're doing if everybody around you is doing something different, but in the long run,
it's better for everybody.
And it's just, you know, it's like I've said many times, just being neighborly, everything's going to work better that way. And it's, you know, the world of communication just has to happen.
And you know, for a lot of times, especially in these areas we're talking about, that communication wasn't taking place. I think a lot of people, because of land rent prices and things like that, they didn't want to talk. They didn't want to communicate. They didn't want anybody to know anything about their business. But now they're having to get together and talk. I think in the long run, that will help probably in a lot of areas. So,
I think, the other thing is that we were talking about, I guess, earlier was not all of your neighbors plant their beans at the same time. So when you're spraying yours over the top, you know, your neighbors may not be very big at all, you know, and just, you know, that's also can cause some issues too, you know, with those applications.
Yeah. Yeah. So just being aware of what's around you, just having that, you know, knowledge and documenting that you've had those conversations. So that's part of, you know, record keeping is a big part of the dicamba label, that you have to have those records. And in Kentucky, they want them immediately. So they want you to be recording them. And they, you know, if it's an hour later and somebody shows up and asks for the records, they want you to have them on you at that point in time. So, but part of that is documenting that you did have those conversations, you know. So It's kind of up to you to figure out how you're going to document that. I don't think you have to have a tape recording of the conversation, but just having documentation that occurred along with all the other things that are required by that label.
And that kind of contradicts some of the legal speak that we've used with pesticide record keeping through the years. A time was a producer had 2 weeks after application to make that recording. You better be doing it before the sprayer pulls into the field now.
Yeah. And it's so on the label, on the federal label, I think it's 72 hours, but Kentucky has made it pretty specific that they want it almost immediately. So that's what our inspectors have been telling us.
Yeah. What, Travis, tell us a little bit, or kind of explain to us a little bit about temperature inversions, because that seems like that's what gets us in trouble sometimes with that deal. And I know it's just kind of, it's going to be hard to explain on the radio, but, you know, kind of do your best and kind of explain that to us.
Yeah, that's no problem. So, yeah, so temperature inversions, it's a phenomenon that happens pretty regularly during the summertime, actually. So what it is, the best way I've ever had to explain to me was basically, if you consider the Earth's crust or the surface is kind of like a hot plate. So during the day, the sun heats that plate or heats the crust of the Earth, and the crust of the Earth then heats the air that's right next to it. And that air warms up, and as it warms up, hot air rises, so it goes up. So that's what's happening during the day. So you have this continual movement of air moving up during the day when the sun's shining, right? And so that's, you know, if you're spraying during those types of conditions, if you have any really fine particles or any fine particles which are going to exist, even with the nozzles producing the biggest droplets, you're still going to have some really fine particles. And if they get caught in the air during those types of conditions, they just keep moving up with the air and, you know, they go away and we don't have to worry about them. And that's, you know, if you, in other industries, that's how they get rid of pollution. So, you know, that's a big deal within other industries that, you know, you run during the sunny days because you don't have to worry about pollution as much. You get it up and out of the atmosphere. So then what happens is you've heated that earth all day long, and then at night the sun goes down, that soil surface starts to cool, and then it cools the air right next to it, but you've been heating the air above it all day long. So you get this cold air that's trapped now against the soil surface. And so it's called a temperature inversion because you've got cold air that's trapped right against the Earth's surface, and all the hot air in the atmosphere that's been heating all day is above it. And you guys, and everybody that's driven an ATV or an open cab tractor or a truck with the windows down in the middle of the summer, going through hills and valleys, right? You're at the top of the hill, it's nice and warm, and you go down into that valley, and it's nice and cool. That's a temperature. You just drove into a temperature inversion. That's what you just drove into, that cool air. And that's what it is. And so, and the key there is you drove into a valley to catch that temperature inversion, right? You go back up on top of the hill and it's warm again. So, the one place where we know temperature inversions are going to happen more often or more consistently is in bottom areas. And where have we had the most issues? Typically in bottoms, right?
That's right. That's right.
You know, for you guys even here, you know, the early years of dicamba, we talked a lot about far western Kentucky and the river, in the Mississippi River bottoms, but there's plenty of river bottoms in this part of the state too. You have the Ohio River, the Green River, and you know, you have all those bottoms as well, a lot of bottom ground, and those temperature inversions will occur there. And really, it's, you know, it's almost, I think we tracked them in Fulton County. We've been tracking them for about 3 years, and you know, in the months of June, we can have 20 out of 30 days with the temperature inversion. So it's almost nightly, and that's why you have the windows on that dicamba label. If you can't spray, it's basically you just spray in the middle of the day, because that helps ensure that you're not in a temperature inversion, knowing that most nights we have a temperature inversion occurring. And that's also why there's a minimum of 3 mile an hour winds. So if you have a 3 mile an hour wind, that means you're getting air disturbance and you're breaking up. That if there was a temperature inversion, it's being,
you're not going to have that trapped pocket of air.
Yeah. So that, and that's why earlier I said, we don't want to be spraying when it's perfectly still. That's why, because if it's perfectly still, there's a chance, it doesn't mean it's happening, but there's a chance that there's a temperature inversion occurring, and it's actually the worst thing we can be doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's completely unrelated to any type of crop production, but for those unfamiliar with the temperature inversion concept, I think of a thermocline in the water, to where you've got hot water sitting on top of cooler water underneath it, and you can feel that definite line. If you ever stepped off a boat,
in a lake.
If you ever stepped off a boat in a lake and you feel that 85, 88 degree water, you know where you're floating and your feet are a lot cooler. That's a temperature inversion. It's the same difference.
Yep, it's the same thing. And we've demonstrated that at some of our clinics. We'll just basically put some cold water and put some hot water right on top of it with different colors. And it's really cool to see. Yep. And you start mixing it up and you see that mixing, and that's your 3 mile an hour wind is mixing that air. Mm-hmm. You know, 3 to 10 miles an hour is mixing that air, and it, you know, helps you out significantly.
We don't have a lot of gravel roads anymore, but, you know, used to, we had a whole lot. And, you know, visually what I always think about when somebody's talking about a temperature inversion is when you're driving down that road and kicking up that dust behind you. You know, when it's just hanging out there and it's not really dropping, it's just hanging there. It's just, it don't, you know, that's a great visual.
It's kind of like cutting beans.
Exactly.
I mean,
that's exactly right.
So dusty, you can't. Yeah, I mean, and you can't just see nothing. There. It just stays there.
Yep,
you know?
Nope, that's exactly
right.
That's
a great visual of what a temperature inversion looks like. If you could, that's something you can visualize in your head.
Yeah, I actually had a guy tell me once, he's like, you just tear down a gravel road, and if the dust doesn't rise, it's a temperature inversion if the dust doesn't rise. So there's smoke bombs too. I mean, you can get smoke bombs and do the same exact thing. You can, you know, just set it out there and let it go, and if the smoke just stays next to the ground, you know it's a temperature inversion. But if it rises,
But normally if we stay within those time limits that are actually on the label, we're probably not going to have as much problems. Nothing's guaranteed, but you won't have as much problems if you, you know, try to spray outside that window.
Yeah, so if you spray within that window and the winds are 3 to 10, it gives you a really good chance that you're not spraying in temperature inversion. Yeah. So that's why those are there.
And, I mean, over the past several years, do you think that most of the damage, or, you know, the drift issues that we talk about, do you think a lot of those are due to the temperature inversion, or do you think it's just all across the board we've had issues of, you know, just off-target movement?
So I think it's across the board, to be honest with you. I think temperature inversions are involved. I don't get me wrong on that. I think they're definitely involved with this process, but I think it's across the board we're having. I've again seen issues where just using the wrong nozzle, or using, you know, spraying when it's too windy, spraying when the wind's blowing towards a sensitive crop. And the other thing, the big factor here is the fact that, you know, typically we're talking about injury on soybean, right? Soybean is probably the most sensitive crop to dicamba. So I think that's the other factor that has really kind of blown this up is, you know, before, it's not saying that there wasn't stuff that was moving around. It just wasn't noticed because we had crops that were more tolerant.
Right. Unmistakable. When you see a dicamba damaged field, it's unmistakable.
Yeah. Our early spring burn downs with corn. There's just not a lot of susceptible crops out there that you're going to see drift to. Having worked in Christian County for a lot of years with a lot of commercial vegetable growing operations, a lot of high tunnels, a lot of greenhouses, I lived in the month of April in greenhouses looking at 2,4-D damage.
Yeah, so. Yeah, exactly. And that's what it is. Is, you know, that was kind of early on, that was the argument of, we've been spraying dicamba and corn forever. What's the difference? And it was, well, we spread it a lot earlier in the season. So
right. And we're planting beans a lot earlier. I know that a lot of my growers here, they start off planting April. Beans, and they'll plant 200 or 300 acres of beans, 400 acres of beans, and then switch over to corn, and then come back to beans. And that's relatively new too. You used to get all your corn planted, then you switched over and planted all your beans, and
the work in those early maturity groups has allowed that to take place. We currently work in counties where there's not a lot of wheat production. You get back down south, Christian County, where I worked for a lot of years, where we had a lot of wheat. We didn't have a lot of full season beans, so you saw very little of that. Yeah. But it's just geographical differences.
Yeah, yeah, and that's a good point with the double crop beans. So the one thing about the dicamba labels that we have to remember, that one of the newest restrictions is June 30th is the last day you can spray dicamba on soybeans. So if you're planting double crop beans,
that's a non-factor for you.
Yeah, you're not going to be spraying dicamba more than likely. Maybe you'll
depending on the year, but I would agree with that.
Yeah, maybe you'll be burning down with it, but your post probably isn't going to be there. So that's when you look at, okay, do I need to use different herbicide technology? Or you have the Xtend Flex soybeans now, so you have Liberty as an option in those as well. So
I think that's come about because of some of the dicamba restrictions. You know, we have, David, you said in the right years, that's probably the biggest change I've seen in production practices in my career is that wheat harvest has gotten earlier and it used to be second week of July when I started in extension back in the middle 90s. Yep. And we paid a lot of attention to being able to get those beans planted because of the yield drag from, you know, later planted. I think one of the reasons we have seen the increase in yield in our double crop beans is because they've backed that wheat harvest up and they've been planted a lot of times by middle of June. You've got your double crop beans in the ground. So.
Yeah. You know, it was second week of July, and then it was got to have everything planted by July the 4th. And I can remember one year when I was down in Tree County that we actually cut wheat at the end of May.
Like May 28th, 30th. I remember that year.
And I was 10, 11. It was in that kind of 9, 10, 11 in that stretch. But I remember doing that. And, you know, so it just depends. But, yeah, by the middle of June, a lot of folks are got their double crop beans in the ground.
I might have come over and cut a wheat harvest plot for y'all really early. Yeah. I think that's why it kind of stands out in my mind.
Yeah, yeah. So, Travis, what are some other things that we need to be looking at this year as far as herbicides go and that type of thing?
Yeah, so another thing that you need to be thinking about, you know, sticking to the dicamba thing is the buffers. So, there are downwind buffers that you have to put in place. So I believe it's 240 foot, I believe, is what it is. So you can include a road ditch, a road, buildings, another field of dicamba tolerant soybean, corn, wheat. You can include that. But if it's if you don't have those, that needs to go into your field. And the other thing to be aware of is that there is certain counties within the state that are considered to have endangered species, and in those counties. I believe there's 12 of them right now, but it changes. It can change. So if you go to label, it'll send you to Bulletin is Live 2 that will give you those counties. But in those counties, you have to have a, I believe it's a 310-foot downwind buffer plus 57-foot on all other sides of the field. So in those counties, for some guys, it's not an option. They just can't. Mm-hmm. They lose their whole field that. And that's all to protect endangered species, and that's something we have to pay attention to and be aware of. So and also just the Enlist labels have a lot of the same restrictions, but their buffers are much less. So they have a lot lower buffers. And the other thing that to be aware of with the Enlist labels, they had some pretty big changes this last year, and that included There were some counties listed where some of the Enlist products couldn't be used. That did not include any counties in Kentucky. So in Kentucky, we've been good, and they've actually changed a bunch of that since. So those are some things to be aware of on those labels. But the other thing I would be just generally talking about post-emerge herbicide applications, weed size. You guys were talking earlier about making sure we get it right and get it right the first time. We need to be spraying 2 to 4 inch weeds. And this year it's critical to do that. And the other thing, you know, in some places, so the last 2 weeks, a lot of crop has gotten into the ground, and it depends on where you're at. But I know there in Princeton, we went from we're really, really wet to we're wanting the rain now. We've missed all these storms that have come through. We've missed them. And so, you know, in that area, we've been putting down residual herbicides, but we haven't gotten any rain on them. So those aren't getting activated. So if you're in that situation that you've been, you know, planting away, putting down all your residuals, but you haven't gotten any rain on them, those residuals probably aren't going to do what you want them to do. And so you may be making that post sooner than you really wanted to, which is unfortunate. I mean, you just, you're at the will of Mother Nature on that. But
we're middle of May, and for 6 months, we've been talking about residual herbicides. And I hate to say it, but these years, the previous years, we've had so much ample moisture. I'm not going to say out loud what we'll probably do, but that's going to play a big problem with these residual herbicides and keeping them activated.
And basically that means you're probably going to be pulling the trigger on your post a little bit sooner, and just making sure as soon as you start seeing those weeds pop through, start making your plan for spraying.
I saw, you know, on the way up here, of course, there was, I believe I've seen more fields worked this spring, that which is a strategy, you know, no doubt, especially with some of the herbicide shortages. But I have seen that flush of weeds already start. I saw one cornfield in particular that in one, of course, it was a little wetter kind of down next to the ditch, but it was solid crabgrass or something. And, you know, they're going to have to make that post application a little quicker on some of that than they probably had planned to, for sure.
Yeah, and the one thing about tillage is, tillage encourages emergence, right?
Absolutely.
And it's a known fact. But the other thing is, you might see some, if you haven't tilled for a while, you might see some weeds that you have not seen in a long time.
Yep.
So that's another thing to be aware of. But that's a great point. I noticed the same thing driving up, a lot more fields tilled that I hadn't seen tilled before. And it's, I understand it. I get why they did it, because they wanted to save the herbicides for the post.
And then your commercial applicators, I mean, they're going to be hit pretty hard here real quick. And, you know, going back to that planning that we've talked about for 6 months too. But, you know, like you said, just knowing what you got out there and getting your name on that list to be able to get your sprayed, because there's going to be a lot of pressure on those folks, because, you know, a lot of corn and beans got planted in a short amount of time.
At the same time.
At the same time, exactly. Yep. And so that's just another reason to be on top of what you think you're going to need.
And knowing what weeds, how important is that going to be, Travis, knowing what weeds you actually have?
Yeah, that's going to be extremely important, because the fact is that some, you know, we're not going to have just the white. We know we don't have as much glyphosate available as we usually do, so you may be wanting a certain tank mix that excludes, you know, one of these broad spectrum herbicides. But when you do that, you need to know what weeds are out there. So knowing what weed species are out there will curtail what you're actually going to be spraying post-emergence. And again, if you tilled, there might be some weeds that pop up that are going to surprise you, and you need to make sure. And maybe your plan is going to cover those weeds, but you need to make sure that what you're spraying does is effective on all the weeds that are in your field.
Absolutely. I tell you, there, you know, just spraying in general, there's just a lot of moving parts and a whole lot of caveats to that. And, you know, just, I mean, from, you know, it's not just picking the herbicide anymore. Yeah. It starts way before then. And then, like you said, just like the weed ID, and, you know, some people's going to have to brush up on that, because, I mean, you know, for so long, you know, we kind of got away from walking those fields. I mean, we really did. And, I mean, we've been spoiled to not really having to to walk the fields, because, I mean, we thought we had it covered. And so it's kind of one of those skills. Sometimes when you don't use that skill, you got to sharpen it back up a little bit.
It's a diminishing skill for sure.
You know,
and we may not have a lot of those rescue treatments available that we have had in the past.
Yeah, we may not have those because we're limited on herbicides, and some guys have already used that rescue treatment. Vicky was talking earlier, you know, some guys went out there really early with the burn downs and had to come back because they just couldn't get get in the field, and they had to make another application that they weren't planning on. And there's other guys. I mean, I've my number one call this year has been ryegrass. Not, guys not being able to kill ryegrass and having to rescue that ryegrass, and so. That, you know, so a lot of those have already happened, and, you know, that may have been your one rescue, right? So if you've already done it, you're pretty lucky to have the one chance, to be honest, in this year, and you may not have another one to go, so.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's the concern, because, you know, you get into a lot of those circumstances where people don't pay attention to what their fields are looking like, and then they drive by and they go, uh-oh. You know, we got a big problem here. And then, and it's going to be a double I-O because you don't know if you're going to be able to get the chemical to rescue it or not.
Right.
And I think, too, I know that I've heard some folks talking that back to the shortage, back to the just the input shortage is that, you know, those companies a lot are they've got enough product to cover their loyal customers that they've had, and they're not as apt to take on somebody new.
Yep.
And so, you know, before sometimes if you bought from two or three different people, then if one you couldn't get on their list, you can get on this other one, get out there a little quicker. That may not be an option this year either. So
yeah it just the herbicides just aren't there. I mean most of what's going to be sold has already been sold. So what's there is what they have, and it's life right now, right? I mean, it's not just the agriculture industry. We've all dealt with something where, you know, we can't get something that we're used to being able to just buy off the shelf without even thinking about it. So
I think that's affected every segment of our population with something. You know, we hear right now about the baby formula issue.
Yep.
And I know a lot of folks are dealing with what we've basically brought on ourselves in the past couple of years with these shutdowns and things like that. So not a political statement. I'm just saying that's part of it.
Hall's cough drops. There's another shortage. Yeah.
Well, you know,
I've heard that.
If we met any place other than Dixon, though, that might not be an issue.
You know, and that's a good way to roll into our timely tip for sure. Stay in control of all variables. How important is that? When we're using dicamba or any other pesticides, to be quite honest with you, temperature, wind speed, wind direction, boom height, neighboring crops, you know, we need to be in as good of control of that as we can be, and we need to document all those things as much as possible, because when they come calling, they're going to want them as all that information as quickly as you can get it to them, and you know, it's they don't play around much.
Having an awareness of what's outside of your own borders, even within, but especially what's outside of your own borders. Travis, you mentioned earlier endangered species. That's something that we have to deal with in certain counties, and it pays people to go out and find that information, because that's not every county, but it's also not stagnant information. It's fluid. It's going to change from time to time. We're going to have counties added to that list. Not likely we'll have some taken away, but more than likely there will be things added to those lists. And
we've just talked briefly about record keeping. I just want to throw this in here before we wind up. But, you know, record keeping, nobody really likes to do the paperwork. And I agree. I mean, I don't like it either. I don't know of anybody that just loves paperwork and record keeping. But, you know, I just encourage, you know, producers to look at that instead of a daunting task, to look at that as a way to really look and see what you're using, and then look back and see what kind of control you got, and make some changes to what your plans are for the next year if you didn't get the control that you wanted. Because we do not remember everything. We can't go back and remember everything we sprayed, and use that as a management tool and not just something that we have to do.
Right. Things about, you know, the biggest one I think about is like wind speed or wind direction. Going to your National Weather Service and looking back 2 weeks or 3 days even, you know, is not a good management practice.
Nope.
Right now.
Nope.
Being able to document that. I have in my little toolbox I've used for years one of the little Kestrel wind meters.
Mm-hmm.
And as cheap as there ought to be one in every spray coop or every sprayer out there, you know, that folks have and are using. And because wind speed and direction changes on you too.
Yeah, it does. And it changes, it, you know, from one field to the next. It changes. So that's a great point.
Or within the same field.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, and I think Vicki had a really good idea there when she was talking about taking those records, and instead of looking at them as a kind of a pain, which they are a pain, but kind of taking those records and going back and see what kind of control you are. Use that as a management tool and make a turn a negative into a positive, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
That'll help you make decisions the next year, you know, as to whether this chemical actually did its job or not.
Right.
So all important stuff. So, Travis, we want to thank you for being a part of our show today. I think it's been a good follow-up. We decided the first time you were on, we wanted to have you prep back pretty quick. And I'm thinking, David, Vicky, we probably another month or so, we may want to revisit some of these.
First returning guest, too, by the way.
That's right.
That's exactly right.
So, it's a pleasure. I always enjoy talking with you guys.
We appreciate you being here and appreciate our hosts for all the work that they do to help bring this show. And we want to thank our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed the show and will make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. Until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters. Good, folks.